policy at this moment of trying to get rid of the Palestinians in Gaza. And so I see a distinct structural parallel and similarity between what Israel is doing in Gaza City at the moment and with Trump's rhetoric of deportation. If Trump had his way, he would literally try to deport every non-white person that he can, and he's getting off to a pretty strong start.
We have to leave it there. Viet Thanh Nguyen, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and scholar. We will see you in New York at Voices of Gaza. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 98.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarlane. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarlane. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. As always, we promise a robust conversation. Today should be no exception. I want to begin the show by thanking my collaborators in this Friday edition of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You know, we call this the Healing Circle, and we do that in homage to, in honor of, the work and the visionary leadership in our community of Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya. She's not with us today. She may join us. She's getting over some stuff, you know, and we're wishing her a full return to health as we speak. But I think it's always wonderful to take time to acknowledge this leadership and this experience that she brings that guides us in this mission as the Healing Circle. So Dr. B, as we call her, is a licensed clinical psychologist and licensed clinical social worker. She's co-founder and serves as the executive director of the African American Child Wellness Institute. I serve on her board of directors. I am the chairman of that board. She also serves as the president of Breakins Consulting and Psychological Services. Her past community service includes organizations such as Greater Minnesota Daycare Alliance. She's been president of the Minnesota Psychological Association, president of the Association of Black Psychologists. She's been president of the Society for the Psychology of Women of the American Psychological Association. She also serves on the State Advisory Council's Subcommittee on Children's Mental Health, and she chairs the Outreach to Diverse Communities Work Group, whose charge is to recommend to the governor strategies for reducing disparities, increasing equitable access to quality mental health. Who also is a partner and leader in this is Dr. Oliver Williams. He's an emeritus professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Minnesota. He retired from the university in June of 2024. And among his many accomplishments, work in creating the institute that studied violence in Black families. He's done pioneering work both here and around the world, around the country. Well, today, and he'll be joining us momentarily. I think he's got some technology challenges at the moment, but he arranged for me to meet with and to invite to today's show a colleague, Dr. William Oliver. And Dr. William Oliver, thank you for being here. Let me introduce you. Dr. William Oliver is Associate Professor Emeritus in criminal justice. His work focuses on the intersectionality of race, gender, and violence. His work is interdisciplinary in that he relies on a number of academic literatures, for example, interpersonal violence, African-American studies, criminal justice policy, and men's studies, all to inform the study of violence among African-Americans. Well, Dr. Oliver was with us last week monitoring the show and posting comments in our chat as Dr. Oliver Williams and I conducted last week's program. And it was just wonderful to have his commentary, his feedback, and his suggestions. And we, at the end of the show, said, look, can you join us this week? And guess what? He's here. Dr. Oliver Good to see you. Thank you for being here. And thank you for last week as well. Thank you so much for being part of that program. Let me have you just talk about yourself and how you've approached your academic career and contributions that you've made now that you've retired.
Well, you know, they say other men work from sun to sun, but a professor's work is never done. I'm a criminologist. I spent the last 26 years of my career at Indiana University, but before that I was at the University of Missouri as well as University of Delaware outside of Philadelphia. I've been interested since I was a young graduate student in Black male street culture and how that, how a life invested in the streets increases the risk of violent crime offending, violent crime victimization. I did one of the first studies of an all Black male sample asking Black men to explain their involvement in violent confrontations that was published in a work called The Violent Social World of Black Men. Later on, as a result of my association with Oliver Williams, I became interested in domestic violence, as well as later on, prisoner reentry. But violence among Black men has been an interest of mine. And I think it has something to do with just how I grew up in upstate New York and being exposed to not so much violence, but Black boy culture, whether it's playground basketball, hanging out on street corners, being around some of the underlife of urban communities in terms of drug use, drug trafficking, prostitution, that type. I saw that. Mm-hmm. And as I became more invested in academia, I wanted to study it. When I went to grad school, I felt that some of the things as I was reading weren't consistent with what I had observed as a youngster. And so I wanted to add my own lens, if you will, to the experience of the streets. If you want me to, I'll say a little bit about how I understand violence. And I've used a, hello, Oliver Williams.
Hello, William Oliver.
I was very much influenced by the work of Robert Staples and the great African-American sociologist. And one of the things that Staples did, there's a lot of things Staples did, but one of the things is that Staples made his work available to not only to members of the academy, but also to the general population via his publications in Essence and Ebony. But that's one thing. But the more important thing was Staples' work was always informed by a conceptual model called the internal colonial model. And, mm-hmm. and he explained everything he wanted to talk about. He explained it in the context of that model, in which he basically argued that African-Americans were similar to a colonized people, mm-hmm. but unlike colonization where a minority is controlling the politics, the economics, the social life of a majority, he argued that we were an internal colony, a minority sort of oppressed within a larger context. Mm-hmm. And I eventually developed a perspective called the structural cultural model, in which I basically argue, and I'll be brief, is that one of the ways in which you explain the disproportionate representation of Black people in general and Black males in particular as violent crime offenders and victims is by looking at the intersection of structure and culture. So it's not all cultural and it's not all structural, but exposure to problematic structural conditions across generations. And if you use the African-American timeline of oppression, 250, 300 years of slavery, 100 years of discrimination, what you end up with is the sort of the echoes of oppression being manifested in a contemporary context in terms of a blocked access to opportunity in the form of education, employment, wealth. And for some people, what that means is living in communities that are really impacted by unemployment, by poverty. And then what I argued is that, so you have adverse structural conditions, and then you have problematic adaptations among some to those adverse structural conditions. And one of those means of problematic adaptation is becoming increasingly invested as an adult in urban street culture, using urban street culture as the site, the location for developing a problematic gender identity and enactment, as well as a lifestyle that increases the risk of offending and or victimization. So I talk about structure, I talk about problematic cultural, or if you know, some people have a problem with culture, problematic lifestyle adaptations to structural oppression. And then I want to link it a little bit to, I mean, mm-hmm. probably going there, but I want to link it a little bit to the current emphasis on utilizing the National Guard to address the violent crime in some of our urban areas. Mm-hmm. I see that as more performative than actually addressing the problems, because if we were to look at any city, whether it be Minneapolis, Chicago, D.C., or whatever, and we draw a large circle around the city and we start placing dots around the areas where there are non-fatal shootings, fatal shootings, and we just do that for the entire area, what we begin to see is that more dots will show up in areas where you have high rates of poverty, high rates of unemployment, high rates of families headed by disadvantaged women. Mm-hmm. And as you move out of that area, you'll see fewer dots, and those fewer dots will be in areas where there's more home ownership, where there's more higher income and stable families. So that leads me to conclude, like many others have concluded, going back to the origin of criminology, is that problematic social conditions is sort of fertile ground for criminal activity. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have a long and a short term plan with regard to how you address the violence problem, a short term, I mean, you know, increasing law enforcement and, you know, having speedy prosecutions and things of this nature, along with addressing these adverse social conditions that lead individuals to pursue significance and status via problematic means, you'll never really address the crime problem.
So that's what a great opening. That's a awesome analysis and presentation, and just inspiring me to take notes and raise questions that I'll share with you. Let me first, though, welcome back our colleague and friend and my co-host, Dr. Oliver Williams. Dr. Williams, thank you for making the connection with William Oliver, Dr. William Oliver.
Yeah. This
is, as you predicted, a great conversation already.
That's right. Well, that's typical when working with William Oliver. And it, just to note, Bob Staples is a mentor of mine. Mm-hmm. And then his last book on Black families. And he had a connection with the University of Minnesota, and also a strong connection with Dr. Paul Rosenblatt. So he was a good man. He passed away a few years ago, but mm-hmm. a good man.
Mm-hmm. Give us a synopsis of the things you mentioned last week, if you would, Dr. Oliver Williams. Well, what were the takeaways for people listening last week that we can bring into today's conversation?
Well, you know, some of the things that William talked about, but one of the things that I think about is that your environment does have an influence on how you see the world and how you respond to it. And as William talked about things that he was exposed to, and I was exposed to similar things when I was growing up. And, you know, dealing with challenges, it was an environment that produced violence. I remember growing up and telling people, I said, you know, when I was growing up in grade school, it wasn't a question of whether or not a fight was going to happen or some ruckus. The question was when it was going to happen, mm-hmm. you know? And so, and you know, I grew up in an environment that was not as bad as some environment, but it was worse than others. So when we went to school, the reality was the fact that as I got into kindergarten and second, and by the time I was in second, third grade, it was on. So the question wasn't whether or not violence is going to happen. It was what time it was going to happen. And then, and that's when my mother and father pulled me out of that school and put me in another school. And the likelihood of violence was much less in that other environment than it was in the environment that I originally went to. And if I had gone to junior high school and high school in that environment, it was going to be a mess.
And so were both elementary schools Black, or what was the difference?
It ended up being all Black. Mm-hmm. And so, growing up in Detroit, and so there were other environments, if you trace the history of the city of Detroit, we were considered blockbusters because mm-hmm. we were a Black family that moved into what was considered a white neighborhood, a historic neighborhood in the city. And then it was primarily white. And then more Black people came into the community, came into the neighborhood, and it became all Black. And then, but the other thing is the fact that as integration took place, if you go back and look at the history of the city, people didn't want to integrate. Mm-hmm. They fought that tooth and nail in the city.
Which people did? Our people or their people?
Oh, white people.
Okay.
And so, and it was interesting that there were some neighborhoods in the city of Detroit that continued to be Black, but had less violence than mm-hmm. The neighborhood that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. But there were people who were really trying to resist integration of neighborhoods, but also resist integration of schools. Mm-hmm. And you can go back and look at school integration in other cities like in Arkansas and other places, but check out Detroit. Go back and look at the films that took place in those, and it was very, very challenging. And there was as much of a challenge in the city of Detroit as it was any place in the country.
Well, so, Dr. William Oliver, you talked about your growing up in upstate New York. Tell me your story. And here's what I took from what you said, that you were not in a particular specific environment that made you a participant in cultural violence, but you were close enough to it, and it was around sort of in the ambient space that made you both aware, conscious of, but also able to discern.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up? And talk about that growing up, just as Dr. Oliver Williams has.
Yeah, I grew up in Utica, New York, which is right next to Syracuse. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a very ethnically diverse city and a very ethnically diverse neighborhood. So I don't recall a lot of overt racial discrimination growing up. What I recall most after I got in high school is boys beginning to spend a lot more time in male dominated street corner settings.
Black boys or boys in general?
Black boys.
Okay.
Black boys.
And so how many Black, were you in a Black school in Utica? Did they have a Black school there? I can't imagine that there is one.
They had a Black elementary school.
Okay.
And then they had, it was critical mass of Blacks.
Okay.
But they also had Black neighborhoods.
Okay.
I lived in an integrated neighborhood.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And I lived in a neighborhood of working class blacks and Italians, mm-hmm. to a predominantly Italian middle school, mm-hmm. went to a very integrated high school. But what it stands out about my experience growing up is 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 years old, spending a lot of times in the nightlife areas of the black community. Mm-hmm. So, and this is where some boys would eventually go on to use drugs, go on to sell drugs, go mm-hmm. on to commit robbery if they didn't go to the military or they didn't go into factory work or if they weren't as fortunate as I to go on to college. Mm-hmm. All right. And so you would have boys who become grown men, 30, 40, 50 years old, having spent 20, 30 years in street corner sort of settings and being involved in street corner lifestyles and things of that nature. So it wasn't so much violence at school as violence in the streets, mm-hmm. and violence in those social settings that make up a part of inner city street culture. So I'm talking certain street corners, bars, pool rooms, gambling parlors, and other places where individuals congregate for a legitimate social activity, but environments that are a site for legitimate social activity can also be sites for illegitimate social activity. And it's the illegitimate social activity that can give rise to disputes that culminate in violence, especially among those who are committed to street life as part of the way they earn money or the way in which they're pursuing a certain identity that might be valued by some in the community.
And so how does that identity situation emerge? I think that's a wonderful way to get into what makes us us, right? How we become who we have become, who we're becoming. How, as you think back to when you were 8, 9, 10 years old, 14 years old, and think of the iconic characters that made up your family and community. Where was this icon of the Black underworld player? Where urban myth, or was there a reality based on the, you know, the bars, the where we socialized? How much was myth, how much was reality, and how much drove what? And how did it manifest in us in our experience becoming over-incarcerated, maybe over-victimizing ourselves in and through violence?
You know, that's a interesting question, and I'm going to try to provide a nuanced response to that.
Okay.
I was exposed to legitimate, good male role models in my church, in my neighborhood, working men. And then as a evolving teenager, I was going to environments where both legitimate people who were on legitimate paths and people who were on illegitimate paths interacting in the same social settings, mm-hmm. especially bars, after hour joints, just on the public streets, public parks. So it wasn't like I was exposed to one thing. I was mm-hmm. exposed to both. Mm-hmm. But one thing about, I will say this, one thing about how I grew up compared to the last 30 years or so, our young people have produced a popular culture art form that has, at least in the past, I don't know so much in the contemporary times, but it actually glorified involvement in the streets. So my soundtrack is a James Brown, OJ's, Frankie Beverly, Whispers, kind of soundtrack, Confunction, Ohio Players kind of soundtrack. I don't have any, and I don't have as part of my upbringing as a teenager transitioning to adulthood, a soundtrack that is talking about violence or prostitution and things of that nature. And now the exception to that would be for people of our age would be if you've been exposed to maybe some blues music. But in the blues music, it's usually the person who's part of the underworld is not so much glorified as much as they're shown as an example of the bad things that can happen to you. Mm-hmm. So, and you might even go back and say that in the late 60s, early 70s with so-called black exploitation movies, that was when we first got exposed to some popular culture artifacts that might have glorified some type of hustling or pimping or prostitution. But that was in some ways kind of situational. For example, if you think about our age range and group, if you think about like 67 through about 70 or 71, you a period of black consciousness. And then in 71, 72, we have the film Superfly. And in my community, I had a lot of people trying to imitate Superfly. Mm-hmm. That was the first example that I can remember of a popular culture artifact becoming a part of the culture where people were trying to...
Explain that a little bit. So imitate Superfly, why and how? What parts of Superfly? Because that film had a lot of different messages in it.
I had people I grew up who were looking like Superfly. Wearing Coke spoons, perming their hair, you know, went from an afro to a perm. Mm-hmm. You know, and identifying, I would say, most with that style of masculinity. Mm-hmm. Also a masculinity of empowerment. Now, when I was a boy, I would go to church and I would be exposed to a lot of dressed up, dignified black men. Mm-hmm. But during the week, those men were janitors, mm-hmm. or trash men. But in the church, they found dignity. And I would imagine in their social clubs like Masons or the Eastern Star, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But it always struck me as interesting that these men of great dignity and power at church were men who had very little status in the larger society. And to me, that emulation of characters like Superfly and others in those black exploitation movies represent to me a search for status. And so the attraction, I find that the attraction to street life and the, whether it's drug trafficking or robbery to get material items to as a way of representation is a search for status. And so moving around a little bit, one of the things that I think is really important if we want to really get a handle on reducing the high rates of violence is how do we disrupt the transition boyhood, legitimate boyhood pursuits to becoming identifying with the streets as a part of how one achieves status, how one achieves manhood. How do we disrupt that? And we disrupt that by having more support for them in school or vocational training, employment, anything that, because a young man who's pursuing education or pursuing employment or pursuing fatherhood or family life has less time to be available for involvement in street activities. It's difficult to do both of those successfully.
Dr. Oliver Williams, what about it?
Well, it's very similar to what William said, except for me, I think that people went from the short haircuts. They used to call them when I was a kid, covadas.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Covadas, haircuts. And then they went from that to perms.
Oh, hold up. What high school class are you gentlemen both from? I'm 65. How about you, Oliver and William? What class are you all?
William is a little younger than me. I graduated in 71.
Okay, so I'm class of 65. Okay, now that gives us all a picture there. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. And so when I was growing up, now I grew up in the city of Detroit, so my soundtrack was Motown. Mm-hmm. And so, and it was all about Motown, and then the Philly sound came in somewhere, but it was basically Motown. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up, you went from the Covadas to the short haircuts to the Process. And then you had the Afro. And then they had the Afro, the people perming their hair. So and so that is similar in terms of what we saw in Detroit, too, with regard to those different processes. Because, you know, the Temptations at one point had the Process. Mm-hmm. And as well as a lot of people during that time. Mm-hmm. And Smokey had a Process. Mm-hmm. And so they're doing that. But then you had the period of time when we were sort of coming out and we had a stronger and a different identity. And then Superfly came out where you I think, and I also think that there's something where Black people tended to use church as a way to establish status historically.
Right.
You know, so they didn't have it in the fields, but they had it in the church.
Right.
Didn't have it in the community or at work, but they had it in the church.
Right.
And it was an interesting sort of development in terms of how we situated ourselves. But I also thought that we were more connected to one another through church and through community, you know, at one point. Then I think, you know, the issue about street hustlers evolved a bit more. But, you know, there's some movies we can take a look at. You know, there's a movie called Detroit that Catherine Bigelow, who did that, talked about the Detroit riot and the challenges that happened in the city of Detroit during the riot and how the riot kind of started, although I lived around the block from where the riot started. So, and police came in and harassed the community. There was supposedly a blind pig that they busted into and shot at people. I won't go on all into that, but but the thing is that people were partying. And the police would come in and harass them. They would, you know, shot some people. And then there was a police group called Stretch. And their responsibility was to come into the city and cause stress among Black people. And there were white policemen that came in and caused that all that stress. And people got tired of being bullied. And so they fought back. But all the other things that you saw in terms of shooting people and the disproportionate harassment that exists still today and how the police got out of it, you know, also in the movie, you know, told some interesting stories about how people were affected, the trauma that they experienced, all that. And so, so I think that one of the other things, too, is that people sort of not only were affected, but, you know, different attitudes emerged. And I thought that there has been an overemphasis on street culture. And, you know, I mean, it certainly exists. Certainly it got, you know, in my experience, got more challenging as we got older. But instead of talking about as many of the positive images that existed, you know, of Black men and Black communities and women in our communities, it's tended to be an overemphasis on, in my opinion, the negative images rather than more of the positive images, which existed also. As I think William said that too.
Yes.
And said that, you know, the positive images still existed. And so, but we depended on each other a lot more and differently than we have. And one of the things that I think is a challenge now is the fact that we haven't turned to our internal supports as much as we need to.
Can I follow up? Can I follow up with that just briefly, Oliver? I didn't mean to interrupt you. I wanted to say this in response to some of the things that you said. There's two points I want to make. One is that I used to say to my students in one of my classes that during slavery, Black people had a collective agenda. They wanted to be free. Mm-hmm. After slavery, up until 68 or so, another 100 years, we had a collective agenda. We wanted first-class citizenship.
Right.
All of the manifestations through discrimination to be dismantled. So for most of our sojourn in the country as a racial minority that has been oppressed, we sort of lived together. And so as the barriers to mobility have been dismantled,
right,
people who were more, to use a William Julius Wilson term, advantaged were able to move out and away. And so there's the period of time where you have the teachers and the lawyers and the doctors and the dentists and the grocery owners and the business people who are living in the same areas and become role models for a certain degree of aspiration, what I can achieve, what I can be. And even if you're not interacting with them, you see them and you see this as something that is potentially accessible to you.
Mm-hmm.
What we have now, and why I do think street culture is so important, is because those role models are not present. And so what we have now is the people who tend to be successful, for the most part, tend to be people who are involved in some type of problematic behavior, because the advantaged people have moved out to better neighborhoods or even to the suburbs. And even now, if you think about it, many of our churches are increasingly becoming very class stratified. You know, so you have these smaller churches that are, you know, lower and working class people, and then you have these big mega churches, 500, 600, 700 thousands of people, very, very bourgeois, to say the least. And so I think a big problem that we have is the lack of role models that we can feel and touch and see on a regular basis. And so William Julius Wilson reported in one of his studies that he interviewed some kids in inner city Chicago that they didn't have anyone in their relational or friendship networks who had a professional employment. You know, so these were not the people that they were seeing and touching and encountering as someone that they knew.
Right.
And I think that provides a context for others to become significant as role models. And I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I think that there was a time, you know, I think about people that lived in my neighborhood when I was growing up. You know, there were doctors, there were teachers, there were ministers. And as the time evolved, a lot of those people, when the blocks were being busted, and as time, you know, moved on and people could move into those spaces more easily, mm-hmm. people tended to move. But, you know, still, one of the things that I felt was the fact that as stories have been told about it, people would talk about one thing without talking about the other.
Okay.
And so when Superfly came out, those other images still existed.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right that they were less proximal,
mm-hmm.
I think, to some people as time moved on. You couldn't, one of the things that used to happen too is that if you needed to get in contact with somebody because you had a problem, you'd go to church and you'd see somebody who did work in an area as a social worker, as a teacher, as whatever, and as a minister, and then you go and talk to them and you could get things hooked up. I've seen churches where they had something internal in terms of trying to be a resource and a referral source for people within the church. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a question of, there's some churches that are more structured to still do that, but there's some churches that are not.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Back to the question of this image and the idea and the accessibility of violence as a solution, particularly among Black boys, Black men. You know, we talked last week, Dr. Oliver Williams, I talked about growing up and as a parent, young, you know, spanking my kids, my daughters, yeah. Right? And right. Until I finally got the aha moment that this was a waste of time right. And just not the solution right. To anything, that I was really hurting by passing on behavior that didn't work. And Dr. Oliver, you said that, you know, we were products of our experience, but that didn't mean we had to be locked into it. And we had to yeah. Embrace our ability to change, to grow that's as right. We were able to know more and better. Dr. William Oliver, you talked about a couple of things I wanted you to lean into a little more. One is the notion of during the period of slavery, the certain single-mindedness of the culture, of right. The entire group of people. Right. And that also existed beyond slavery through the, you know, next 100 years or so.
That's
so
right.
That single-minded, mission-driven agenda, you know, what forged that? We know the answer, but you can talk about it. And you also talked about colonization, the experience of African people in colonies, Europeans, a minority invading and controlling lands that Africans lived in and subjecting them as colonies. And you made the comparison between that and our experience as enslaved individuals, but a culture in a sense colonized within a larger culture of European making. And of late, I've heard the term that I love, and I want to see how it sounds to you. The term is, how do we begin to decolonize our minds? And decolonizing is a process and a concept that can and should and may apply to all of us, whether we were in the colonial experience, meaning in Nigeria or Mali or anywhere on the continent that suffered European domination after the Germans decide who's going on what, you know, after they finished doing the transatlantic slave trade, which was their primary business. But it also applies to us here in this country, colonized as you described us. What does that mean? How do we decolonize our minds? And I'm asking the question in the context of understanding how this dynamic of being victims is the first word, but it's not the right word, shaped by external power.
Mm-hmm.
In part reflects a reaction to and a certain pressure from outside. So I'll stop there. What do you think?
One of the things that I think, and then I'll let William take it, is that, you know, what Florida and Trump have been trying to do in terms of erasing our history is a problem. Because the goal is for you not to know about who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that we haven't contributed anything, but we've contributed things throughout. And then to still have things present so people could go visit and be informed about it more readily. And not just, I mean, African-Americans clearly, but also the rest of the country. So stealing and ignoring our and excluding our history is a problem. So that's what I wanted to say. Go ahead, Wade.
I want to try to say a couple of things. With regard, let's go back to that collective agenda business first. When I grew up in upstate New York, I had Jewish friends who also had to go to Hebrew school, yeshiva. And one of the things that I have come to learn and really admire about the yeshiva is that the yeshiva is a private organization funded by Jewish people. And the mission of the yeshiva, one of the missions, is to introduce Jewish people to their history and culture, right, unfiltered, and to also give them a sense of identity and a sense of mission. So when I was younger and a little bit more excitable, I would say to Black people, where is your yeshiva? Where is your Hebrew school? And the Jewish people maintain the Hebrew school because they have a collective agenda formed around the philosophy, never again. And it is promoted, the political message is promoted like a religious message. Mm-hmm. I would argue that when we get to 1968 and we start seeing the dismantling of overt racial discrimination, and there's opportunities for advantaged and other people who are not advantaged, but opportunities and employment, and you have mobility, what we didn't continue to have is this, we really, in some ways, concluded that, okay, we're free to access all the opportunity and legitimate means in the society to pursue the American dream. Mm-hmm. And not recognizing that racism and racial discrimination evolves. It morphs into another form, more subtle. And so one of our failings as a people and our leaders is that we haven't maintained a sense of collective identity and collective responsibility. And I hate to say it, but as a person who grew up during the 60s and was very much influenced by notions of Black unity and things of that nature, I'm very pessimistic. Because we have, you know, we have some of our children now who are young college students or whatever, or young professionals. You know, they're going on Mediterranean cruises. They spending 2 or 3 weeks a month in Greece. And so, and for many of them, there is no attachment to the collective mission. What is the collective mission? What is the collective agenda of Black people in 21st century America? So I would argue that one of our greatest problems, and I don't see how it can be rectified in the masses. I think there may be a movement. If a movement emerges, it's going to emerge among the grassroots. It's not going to emerge among privileged people who can go to Spain and go to Italy and go to Africa or whatever. It's not going to be something that emanates from the bourgeoisie. It's going to be something that emanates from people who are dealing with some very tough issues and challenges in their community. So I would argue that in contemporary America today, Black people do not have a collective agenda. And that is a problem because there's nothing wrong with mobility, but do you still have any responsibility or sense of obligation to the uplift of those who are not as privileged or mobile as you? I think that's a point, a very important point. You said something about the erasure of history or the decolonizing our minds.
Yep.
I don't see how you can decolonize your mind if you don't have an agenda that promotes the decolonization of your mind. So we can have like Al McFarlane can raise his children in a way in which he exposes them to African-American history, our experiences with racial oppression, but next door neighbors, no, we just want you to go to med school and get a big house. And we want to go on vacation in Florida and stuff like that. You know, so it's not, you know, so what's the point of your kids being woke and the next door neighbor's kids being asleep? You know, I just don't see how it's going. I wrote a paper one time. I wrote a paper a long time ago called Black Males and Social Problems, Prevention Through Afrocentric Socialization. And I was really spouting the ideology, the teachings of Malana Karanga, with especially the principles of Kwanzaa and how they, he meant for them to be an everyday aspect of our moral values. Mm-hmm. And what would happen if we raised our boys in ways in which we adhered to those principles of collective responsibility, purpose, collective economics? But I don't think that that's going to ever happen now, because there are too many incentives to be bourgeois. There's too many incentives to just pursue the good life. And then along with that, we exist within a context that suggests that racial discrimination is gone. And if you're a failure today in modern America, it's because you have not adequately pursued the discipline and the opportunities that are available to you.
So one of the best interviews I've ever done, I think, was with a guy named Vice President Riek Machar. Riek Machar was the Vice President of South Sudan. He was the Vice Commander of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, SPLA, and he was the Vice Chair of the Sudanese People's National Movement, the political body. Mm-hmm. He talked about how he and John Garang were both university professors in Khartoum, and that they were among many, but the two of them together specifically grew tired of the perpetual and institutional denigration mm-hmm. of the Africans in Sudan. And he drew the distinction between the Africans and the Arabized Africans. Mm-hmm. And so we're on the radio. I said, Arabized Africans, what's that? What does an Arabized African look like? And he says, well, they look like you. So what? Well, you are an Americanized African, just like they are Arabized Africans.
Yes.
But you both have been reared and acculturated yes. into an agenda, an ideology, a process, a system, yes. a structure that elevates their values, but denies the possibility that you have values, meaning, purpose that matters.
Yes.
Your life, your history, your culture don't matter. He said, so we left and we went to the country side and organized armies, and we fought a guerrilla warfare for X number of years. And I know, he said, we're responsible for the death of 5 million people mm-hmm. in those wars. Mm-hmm. And what he regretted most was the fact that part of their military resistance and struggle with the North, the Arabized Africans, the Sudanese from Khartoum, in doing that, they recruited and train child soldiers, mm-hmm. children who are 9, mm-hmm. 10, 12, 13, armed them with AK-47s and sent them into the bush to fight and kill. Mm-hmm. He said, now that we've ended the military, our challenge is to re-socialize these children so that they can be children again or become productive human beings that have a different attitude towards violence. So I bring this up to say, there's a case of organized violence with and among and young people in the name of the state, a state in formation. It wasn't the state yet. But there was a process for acculturating. So I'm mm-hmm. trying to think, what processes are there for the boys and girls in our neighborhoods who, because of their youth, are, I don't know what the right word is, but, you know, are malleable mm-hmm. and impressionable mm-hmm. and experience different invitations, some without being recruited, but they can be attracted to what you call the cultural challenges. One could be the street life, others could be the academic, others could be the military, others could be the factory. But those are the options. So what is our duty, our obligation to recognize something universal in this experience of growing up mm-hmm. and looking at that growing up in a place like Sudan, where it meant the violence of war as part of nation building, and what it means in Utica where it means something different, but it's still young people. And what is our, and maybe I'm putting apples and oranges together, maybe I'm not seeing this right, but what do you think, Dr. William Oliver, what do you think?
I think the issue gets back to duty. How do we agree on a common duty, a common obligation, a common responsibility? So my response to that would be I don't know how to put this, but I would modify my aspirations with regard to what's achievable. And I think that, or what we could do, we, mm-hmm. Because I don't think that there is a sense of we.
Okay.
And I don't think that we're going to ever have a great sense of we again. I think we have situational we-ness. So we have situational we-ness when George Floyd was killed up there in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And that situational we-ness transcended Minnesota and was all over the place.
Yep.
Okay, but now it's dissipated.
Yep.
You know, and because we really don't have, our institutions are not organized in a way to continue to promote a sense of urgency about problematic conditions that give rise to even greater problematic conditions, or how problematic social conditions persist for certain groups of people. But so I'll just say this. When I was in the classroom, I had a class called Violence in the Black Community. And at one point we would start talking about prevention. And we go through criminal justice preventions, community preventions. My thinking is this: pregnancy prevention is violence prevention. Hmm. You say, how so? If you can, teenage pregnancy prevention. Mm-hmm. If you can, a teenager getting pregnant in modern America is like taking a rocket ship to poverty. Hmm. For most teenagers. Most teenagers get ready to be poor. Mm-hmm. If you're having a baby at 16, 17 years old and you don't have any educational skills, you're in a problematic circumstance. Mm-hmm. So I would say that teenage pregnancy prevention programs is a form of violence prevention.
Okay.
School retention is violence prevention. If you can get individuals to graduate from high school, go on to vocational training of some type, whether it's academic or traditional vocational careers, they're now in a better position to maintain themselves. They can expand the horizons of their lifestyle individually and for those, their loved ones. So I would say we need to start at that level. If you can, we have a lot of Black boys who become young Black men and older Black men that have a lot of anger because they have not been sufficiently nurtured by the men in their fathers or other men within their family networks. I have met young men and they're mad at me and they don't even know me. And I'm like a representative, a symbol of Black male failure. Failure to love them, failure to nurture them, failure to guide them. So mentoring programs where you are linking functioning men with boys, especially boys at risk. Violence prevention, in my estimation. After school programs, violence prevention. I would start small there. And when we have opportunities like the death of George Floyd or the young man that was killed up in your area by the police officer when he told the police officer he had a weapon in the vehicle. I can't remember his name right now. I apologize. Yes. You know, we have to take advantage of those. We have to take advantage of those situations to bring attention to problematic policing and to promote. You probably heard some of the chiefs up there talking about we're in the constitutional policing. I did a workshop with the police one time and I told them that I didn't care if the police were racially biased. I just want the police to, so you can be as biased as you want to be when you're off duty. Mm-hmm. But when you're on duty, I want you to be professional within the context of what is called constitutional policing. That is, you respect the rights of all citizens. And if you do that, we're less likely to have problematic incidents, and then you could go to a Klan rally after you get off work. I'm okay with that.
That's your business. Listen, we're out of time. What a wonderful hour. It goes so quickly. But I want to continue this conversation. And Dr. Williams and Dr. Oliver, maybe the both of you could join us again next week. So I think this is an important topic, and we just touched the surface. And I want to thank one of our viewers, the Big Cheese, for his comments. He said that the best way to confront crime and gun violence in the Black community is demanding reparations and tangibles. Most criminal activity is a result of economic deprivation and WS, I'm not sure what white supremacy